and you scroll down to under the cell membrane image, the reference, if you're going to include these chemical references, you know, like the actual designations, you know, like ClO2 negative and stuff like that.
Yeah.
When you mention chloride matrix, you always have to include acetic acid or whatever mild acid.
Okay.
Okay, so you would have, if you're going to write that molecule out, you're going to have to include the C. The chloride matrix, it involves sodium chloride, which is ClO2 negative, but it has to be converted. It has to become an acetate. In other words, that's what the chloride matrix is. It's the activated or detoxified version, right?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so it'll be ClO, like, you know, if you don't want to get picked apart on this, you know, from the people out there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so you'll have to define the chloride matrix without the designation. Just state that the chloride matrix is, or, you know, like you can put chloride matrix or sodium chloride with citric acid.
Got it.
Because people are not going to know what that means, the ClO2 negative stuff. Hell, no, nobody knows what that is.
I know they don't. Particularly the negative part of it, because
yeah.
I mean, I understand ClO2 is a chlorine with two atoms of oxygen,
yeah.
But it's the that negative sign that which
well,
is dismissible.
There's another thing. The reason that I'm actually talking about this, Adam, this is not a chemistry lesson or chemistry, you know, Chem 101. Basically, you have to look at the origin of the chlorine and the actions forward. So if you were to write this out, you would actually be looking at sodium chloride, right?
Yeah.
And then you'd have to put an arrow, and then you'd have to put in sodium chloride, then put in an arrow, because of the next process, then you would have to put in sodium chloride.
Got it.
You know, because it originates with the sodium, the chloride, eh? It's the salt, table salt.
Uh-huh.
But I shouldn't say table salt. We can't even use the term table salt now, because you don't want to make this stuff out of table salt. Make it out of pure sodium chloride. Because of the additives that are in table salt. Everything from, there's actually aluminum in table salt too. And there's recycled drywall and a whole bunch of other shit that's actually added to salt as filler.
Uh-huh.
And depending on where the salt came from, basically what salt mine or what process, you know, in other words, if it was the electrolysis of seawater, well, there's going to be every element known to man in it. But if it is chemically pure, like let's say in the case of the best version of the chlorate matrix.
Yeah.
Now you're looking at a pure chemical entity to begin with. So you want pharmaceutical grade, you know, like let's say you go to a dispensing pharmacy,
mm-hmm.
and you buy the pure salt. And then you do the electrolysis. So now you can see how the one molecule becomes another. So that's how you would have to write it out if you wanted to get, right into that. But I'm here to tell you that I know that anyone who is actually experienced in chemistry will look at the written words and know exactly what the equations and the processes are. That all you'd have to do is say, let's say sodium chloride, and then the next word would be electrolysis, and then the next word would be sodium chlorate, because that's predominant, and then, you know, that's the most molecule produced, and then sodium chlorite, which is the least molecule produced. And then you separate the sodium chlorate and sodium chloride with another electrolysis process to get to the pure sodium chloride. And then you would add the pure water. So now you can see what this equation looks like when you write it out, eh?
Okay.
And now who's going to understand that? And I'm here to tell you that when ordinary people, if you take their brain away from, you know, basically what they see. You know, in other words, present questions that can, offer a tangent, a new train of thought.
Yeah.
Well, they lose it right there. That's the end of it. So if it's done in the simplest terms, you know, like, so let's say if you just wrote the words, well, this becomes this through this, this becomes this through this, this has to be, you know, like, let's say the the anode and cathode, first carbon, and then the anode and cathode, both. And there's another thing here. When you're looking at electrolysis, if you want to get really into it, you're going to find out that the attraction sometimes goes to the negative. In other words, you have an anode and a cathode. One is positive, one is negative. Some ions go to the positive, collect at the positive, or collect because of the positive.
Right.
Some ions collect because of the negative. Now you can see where I'm going with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and these are the ways to determine the differences in ions. So where does it collect, and what causes it to collect? But if you look at the chemistry, I can't say it any plainer here. If you just write it out using the words, then because every time I look at this, and I realize every time I look at this, I realize what it is. But unless you got some kid that's in, let's say, grade 11, grade 12 chemistry, and really knows this shit, and knows the processes, because there'd be some people in university also, but how many people are taking chem in universities?
No, I agree.
Hardly any, right?
Yeah.
So if you had a, let's say, a 10,000 student population, what would we be talking about that are actually taking the chemistry as part of their deal, What would you be looking at? Maybe, 90 people?
Yeah. A few hundred at generously, yeah.
Yeah, generously. And then some of them guys would just be taking it to pick up classes.
Yeah.
Because they think they're, they have to appear smart, so they take the chem, right? The bottom line on it is hardly anyone knows. I mean, especially the people reading these blogs and in the internet, it would be an incredibly rare occasion to find someone who looked at, let's say, the words that I just suggested,
mm-hmm.
and see the processes involved. It would be something rare.
Mm.
And then, of course, that would take them away from the point of the conversation and get them to thinking all the way back to when they were in school trying to remember the damn chemistry.
Well, since I was astute enough to set this up and just make certain that the audio is fine, I can even put I can put a little thing on there with an explanation right there as people get to it, because you clarify.
You don't actually have to even do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically all you have to do is tell the people how to make it. That's the simplified. I'll tell you what, in the encyclopedia of electrolysis, the processes involved in this involve three relatively short paragraphs.
Okay.
That's all it is.
Ah.
It is that simple.
Okay.
So, this is not rocket science, but the thing is, you have to tell the people which products to start with.
Right.
Which sort of electricity is demanded, in other words, the 9-volt batteries. The length of the wires are not important, but the size of the wires should be small, let's say 16 or 18 gauge. And the first process involves the anode and cathode are carbon, like flashlight battery carbon. That's basically what it is. And, of course, you're going to neutralize the acid in the carbon with citric acid. You'll just clean it with a mild acid, eh? A little bit of water and a little bit of orange juice even, eh? To clean the sulfuric acid that's in the battery out of it.
Uh-huh, okay.
To clean the carbon, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, when you run your first electrolysis, you can just put some damn salt water there, run the electrolysis for a while, and boil the carbon out, eh?
Uh-huh.
So then you've got perfectly clean carbon that you use over and over and over for the rest of your life. And then there's the platinum. Now, if you want the pure product, the medical-grade product, you need the platinum. So, there is an encyclopedia. I've actually been trying to relocate it because I had to shut this one damn computer down, and I had to store it in the file, eh? There is a top-quality university encyclopedia on electrolysis, and it is a top-quality version. And in that, every form of electrolysis that you would ever need to know in your complete life, including the electrolysis of metals, of everything that's on the chart of elements, it's all in there. The collective of the world's knowledge regarding electrolysis, is in that encyclopedia. So this is where, like when I looked at, there was howto.com and, ask.com.
Yeah.
Shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those are really simplified things that do tell you the story, but in a very simple way. Mm-hmm. But, then you have to have the chemistry know-how to actually recognize what product and why you're choosing that product to begin with. But now you're back to the pure product. So, like, when I look at this, let's say the chloride matrix thing, as soon as I get to the ClO2 negative, that doesn't define the chloride matrix, eh?
Mm-hmm, okay.
That's like saying that a cow and a horse both produce milk. That's a simple little comparison, eh? Yeah, so if you're going to start doing these equations, you're going to have to write them all out. That's why I would say, again, there's no point in it. In time, the people that are really curious, if someone asks, well, just write out the whole damn thing and publish it. Just say, okay, now this is what it looks like, to a chemist. But when it really boils down to the actual short strokes, what you are doing is you're taking pure salt, sodium chloride, and through electrolysis, using a 9-volt battery, fine copper wire, and carbon, you're producing a combination of sodium chlorate and sodium chlorite that will be approximately 75% to 25%. And then you separate that, and then you get with the platinum. So then you would write it out. All it would take is, one reasonably long sentence. It tells the whole process, eh?
Okay. Hmm. All right.
Because no one is going to crack the books to figure out what the hell it is you wrote. That's the same thing with the mole, eh? When you're looking at actual, the mass, the mole.
Yeah.
Looking at the actual weight. And stuff like that. People aren't going to necessarily know exactly what the hell it is that you're saying there either. There's very few people understand that stuff, all that SI stuff. It's standardized international terms, eh?
Yeah.
SI?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you look at SI and you start looking at actual chemical weights, like the mole and all that kind of stuff, there are two different ways to weigh elements. And the mole seems to be the common, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because you're actually weighing like molecule and stuff like that.
Right, I understand that.
The mole of whatever. Anyway, you don't necessarily have to do that. Basically, what you have to do is teach people how to use a damn dope scale. Those electronic little scales that the drug dealers use?
Yeah, okay.
Well, yeah, that's how to do it. Because now that, you see, and then you just convert the mole into the metric that these dope scales weigh in. Well, they're not used just for dope scales. They're used for lots of different things, eh?
Oh, sure. I have a scale here, but I use it for actually weighing stuff to ship out. So,
yeah. But you understand everything I'm saying. So then all you have to do is figure out or publish the conversion factors to go from the actual chemical designation, let's say mole, to actually in grams. Or in micrograms or whatever. And they're all related. So basically, if you were saying that you wanted to put a batch together that was actually 28%, well, you use this scale with this pure material, exactly this much of this pure material with exactly this weight of water produces this. Because then it's not a mystery, And people have a far less chance of hurting themselves, eh?
Yeah, sure. I see what you're saying.
Yeah. I'm probably starting to piss you off with all of this advice, eh? But, I actually put on the other hat. Every time I look at this stuff, I imagine that I don't know anything. And I'm looking for the answer. Can I possibly understand what I'm looking at? And that's where, that's why as soon as I get to something like this, that actually makes me stop and think.
Well, that's probably that's one of the objectives.
Yeah.
Yeah, oh, that's fine.
Yeah, because you see, several times in here you reference the chloride matrix as ClO2 negative. Remember, we talked about this before. The actual sodium chlorite is ClO2 negative. The chloride matrix involves a mild acid. So if you looked at the percentage of water, that molecule would actually be a real interesting one to write out, because now you need the percentage of water to be included.
Well, that may be one reason why I'm sitting. Well, no, I want to say I'm still writing this next one, because that level or degree of a deeper degree of understanding probably hasn't set in. So essentially, the chlorite, sodium chlorite itself, is not the chlorite matrix.
No, no, the sodium chlorate is just a molecule. And the molecule becomes more complex when you add the water.
Let me back up here then. But sodium, sodium chloride is in ACLO2. The chloride matrix is what happens after the myyl acid has been added to it.
Yes. But on the other hand, you can say ClO2 negative because as soon as water is added to this, it vents it off. And I'm sure that in its natural dry state, it vents off a certain amount of that gas also. You know, when you look at the chem books on this stuff, the reference is clearly made that the sodium chloride can be written ClO2 negative. Now, the thing is that the sodium chloride on its own is definitely producing ClO2 negative as a gas state, whether it's venting it off or whether it's from reacting with water. It's producing a gas, you know, a gaseous state at all time. In other words, it's shedding electrons. And it's actually producing a measurable effect. In other words, if you put a sniffer on a pile of sodium chloride, it's going to read ClO2 negative.
All right.
Okay. And then when you add the water to it, for effect, the water as it's evaporating will carry ClO2 negative as a gas state. It'll produce that. So now the ClO2 negative, the instant that the mild acid, you know, in the MMS case, citric acid, as soon as that mild acid at 10% or however you want to do it, like I really do prefer the 10%, but at 10%, the interaction causes the ongoing release of chlorine dioxide to actually end. Any possible molecule that could be produced, you know, in other words, of ClO2 in a gas state, that comes to an end.
What I think I, if I go from
back to the abstract of that last thing we looked at regarding the actual ending of ClO2 species. In other words, they're talking about a reactive free radical.
Yes.
That's exactly what a dioxin is.
Yeah.
Okay, so the ending of whichever species is produced, and that's ClO2 negative. So in other words, when they refer to the free radical, they're referring to ClO2 negative. That's only produced for a microsecond, and then it ends. And there is no longer any possibility of producing ClO2 negative as a gas. Now, to understand this, you got to look at the three different states of matter, eh?
I get the impression, or at least it seems like if you have sodium chloride and ACLO2, that's ClO2 negative is what you're saying.
Yeah, the chlorate is a negative ion. The chlorate isn't. And you want the negative ion because you want that to be used by yourself. In other words, you want it to have the same state as the stuff that the cell accepts every day.
Yeah.
And you want the molecule to be small also.
All right.
Just like the molecule that this cell accepts every day. Communication across the field. Sodium potassium pump.
Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
What I'm perhaps... have not been getting is that there is something that is a ClO2, not negative, which is chlorine dioxide.
Well, that's another, like the sodium chlorate is the way that you would say that. But the sodium chlorate...
SNaClO3.
Yeah, so when you're back to that stuff again, though, you'd have to look at the complete molecule. You know, what's the charge state? Is it neutral? Because if it's a neutral charge state, the cell will not take it in. The only thing that the cell wants to take in is the actual free radical because of its their charge state. You know? And what is it about a free radical, in other words, these toxic oxygen species, what is it about them that makes them welcome to a cell or want to attach to anything that they come to?
I would imagine their charge.
Well, it's a free radical. So define free radical then. Take a look at exactly how a free radical is, drawn out. And forget about doing the chem with the dots. You know, it's an old way of doing it. You know, look at the newer style. But the bottom line on it is, when you look at, let's say, ClO2 as a radical, or any other radical, as a matter of fact, you know, the reactive oxygen species, you know, the dioxins and stuff like that?
Yeah.
So-called free radicals. There's something that's really interesting about all of them. And, that would be a good thing for you to try to figure out. You know, just look it up, try to find it. Find out what's different about them and what makes them be taken into cells and welcomed into the body. So anyway, you know, always remember the part of this picture that's absolutely critical. None of this can happen without these particular, let's say, the elements involved. The dominant element is going to be a halogen.
Yeah.
So that takes you directly into the whole thing. But now when you combine the chemistry with the Krebs cycle and you find that the chemistry is beneficial, how does the Krebs cycle use it? How does it take it into the cell? You know, this actually wasn't easy to figure out. This took a bit of time.
And it's taken time for me to really comprehend it. I'm doing it in stages.
Yeah.
But it seemed like I get to a stage and then I'm back up because, okay, now I'm not clear on something again. I'm clear on the end result. I'm still not necessarily clear on the process.
Okay, so just started off as two family trees. Now, there are two family trees that will be joined at whatever particular time that you consume the chloride matrix. Now, the one is the family tree of the chloride matrix, how it begins, and the elements, molecules, and processes involved. So you will describe everything that leads up to the production of the actual product that you drink. Right? So you're going to start off with pure salt and pure water. And you're going to start off with 3 liters to a half a cup. 3 liters of water to a half a cup of pure salt, sodium chloride. And then you're going to mix it, very well mix it, in other words, and you're going to have to use heat to do it. The water has to be up to just about to boiling for that salt to actually stay in a state of suspension. So those are the words you'll use. So then you have the liquid... in other words, the brine, in a state of relatively permanent suspension. And from that point forward, then you describe the electrolysis. Now, the electrolysis has to be a small battery, you know, like a 9-volt battery is perfect. Small wire, so you don't drain the battery, because you know that wire resistance equals, the amount of current that flows?
Yeah.
Okay, so the smaller the wire...
the less the resistance. The more the resistance with a smaller wire?
Well, the current only travels on the outside of the wire, so you're only allowing a much lesser amount of current to come out.
Oh, so the surface area affects the capacity.
Yeah. So if there was no resistance, you'd be taking a 9-volt battery and putting both of the poles on your tongue. And that'll drain that battery really quick and make you feel funny while it's doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, so in other words, then there's no resistance. It's just draining the battery with as much energy as can possibly come out of it in any measured moment of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to actually offer resistance there and slowly take the charge out of the battery. You want it to last 16 hours.
So you do that by increasing the surface area of the wire itself.
Increasing it.
Huh?
You decrease the surface area of the wire and the battery lasts longer. You want it to last 16 hours. Yeah.
All right. That when you said no wires put, if you put this directly on the tongue, there was no resistance, so it was decreased.
You drain the battery immediately because there's no reason for it not to dump its charge.
Exactly.
At once.
So and then I said you literally increased the surface area of the wire, making it thicker.
But when you're talking about your tongue, yeah. I see what you're saying.
All right, because if I'm confused, I need to acknowledge the confusion and just clear
it. That's fine. So in other words, the wire you're going to use, probably 18 gauge wire would be good.
Right.
Okay. In other words, because you're producing a much lower volume of energy coming out of the battery. So in other words, energy over time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you could also increase that. You slow it down, in other words, by length of wire, because you can offer more resistance in the length of wire also.
Yes, I know, either the gauge or the length.
Yeah.
Or some combination thereof.
That's right. So now, then you need alligator clips, and you need carbon. And the closer the carbon is together, the more reactive, you know, the more effective, reactive the electrolysis is. Now, you have to determine the absolute best distances. Now, when it comes to doing hydrogen, I've settled on 125 thousandths of an inch. And I do know that you get a more complete process with the carbons closer together. So, knowing these things, I would prefer to set these carbons at a quarter of an inch apart. You know, it's 250 thou. You know, that would be, in other words, you can place the carbons in whatever the hell that's not conductive at all. You know, like whatever, plastic or rubber.
Yeah.
You can put, but you can't put anything between them. But if you were to mount them, you got to mount the mounts off the end of the carbon, eh? And it's got to be at the end where the wires go on. And you don't want any communication to take place in between those carbons. You want the communication to take place through the water, the salt water, the carbons to salt water to carbon. Now you want your charge field to go across the saline solution, and that changes the saline solution. But anyway, you figure out a way to mount these carbons so that they're the right distance, even if you can just set it up so they hang properly, eh?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they stay roughly a quarter of an inch apart. You know, once you set this batch down, you know, and you hang those off of, a rod or a wooden dowel or whatever, they're not going to move. You know, there's bubble force going on in there, but there's no current or anything like that.
Okay.
You know, so they're not going to move. If you set them, if you hang them so they're a quarter of an inch apart, well, they'll stay there. So anyway, 16 hours later, you see a whole bunch of flakes in the bottom of the batch. Then you pour the batch off until there's about 4 ounces left. And then you place that batch with all of the crystals in a different sized jar, you know, smaller. Like, let's say, if you put 4 ounces of water, like, you know, like the Humboldt's little bottle, that's 4 ounces, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you had something like that made out of glass or Pyrex or whatever, and you hung two wires of platinum down into it, into 4 ounces of liquid, and all of these flakes of sodium chlorate and sodium chloride, well, they separate out at different heights, you know, because of their charge and stuff like that. And not only that, they separate because they have opposite charges.
Yeah, repulsion, yeah.
Yeah, they actually separate because of that, eh?
Yeah, sure.
And so basically, you want to, I believe the sodium chlorite stays high in the column, but I have to look at it again, eh? I haven't looked at that in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, you can tell right away by the volume, because the flake volume, the large flake volume is the sodium chlorate.
Okay.
And the small flake product, the smaller amount in actual mole or weight or however you want to do it, that is sodium chlorite in its pure form.
Mm-hmm.
So, now if you wanted to write that out using chemistry terms, well, go ahead. I mean, you can do that. You can find all of the little... the indicators of voltage, power, and everything. You know, like, you can dissect that 9-volt battery, you know, like, let's say, look it up, in other words, and produce all of its points. You know, how much energy and how much energy can be released over a period of 16 hours because of the wire size, and it just goes on and on. But do you really care? Because the guy that's reading it, he doesn't give a shit about that. He knows that he wants to go and get some sodium chloride, distilled water, a glass jar, and then follow the process. That's all he knows, right?
Yeah, sure.
But if you were talking to Kalker or one of those other guys, well, you know, if he knows things, well, he's going to know exactly what the hell you're saying. You know, and how to separate this stuff and how to produce the pure product. But then there's another thing about that pure product. You know, you dry the product out and everything, and you have to be really careful about, you know, what you're doing with it, you know, and static and all that other kind of shit, static discharge, static electricity.
Yeah.
And you want to actually place that immediately once it's cured. You want to place that immediately into a batch of distilled water. And there's another thing about this that has to be stated. Pouring one thing into another thing when you're involving reactive compounds,
uh-huh.
That can be a bad thing. You have to know which to pour into the other, and especially the speeds and the temperatures. You know, to stabilize it, eh?
Right, right.
Yes. So now you're seeing the fine print on the chemistry, so now do you want to draw all of that out? Because I'm here to tell you that it's going to be, you know, and then, of course, when you draw it all out, you know, the people are just going to open up the encyclopedia of electrolysis and verify it anyway. You know, so, you know, you can just include the reference. Just say, well, this is per the encyclopedia of whatever from this university. These are the processes. These are how you separate it. And this is what you want. You
sure.
want the sodium chloride.
Yeah.
And the safe way to do this and the safe way to, you know, demonstrate the safe way to actually neutralize it so it's not a hazard. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because once it's neutralized, it stays neutralized. You know, it doesn't heat up. You know, that's another thing about these reactive things. They're endothermic. You ever hear that term?
Yeah, I have.
Okay, so you know where we're going with this, right? Now, we're at a point now where we can actually talk about these things, but how many other people? It's much better to shorten the sentence and shorten the paragraph. Just cut to the chase.
I agree. You got to establish the you know,
I see
the
what
facts.
You're saying. Like you can say it in ordinary terms for ordinary people, and then you can put a secondary or sidebar or whatever, and say, "Well, these are the processes for those of you that know the difference."
Well, yeah. I mean, for you know what I'm about to do or what we are in the process of doing is really somewhat changing the story about MMS, and you know, it's doing a reset. You know, I mean, I early this morning I was talking to this guy who uses MMS, and he's had some good results and stuff like that. But I told him essentially that what we're doing now, and I explained where instead of using the acid to activate to get and generate chlorine dioxide, which is what we've been saying all this time,
yeah.
is that you're literally using the acid as a reagent to detoxify the chlorine dioxide. In other words, to eliminate it.
That's another...
Hold on. Say it. Good. I got a beep coming through there. Hold on. 3, 2, 1. I get one more beep, and then where's that beep? I always get two beeps, and of course now I didn't get one. So anyway, so what were you saying?
Oh, when you said reagent, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. No one's going to know.
Well, I didn't know what it was either, but people who do know what it is know what it is. Who knew what an activator is?
That's right.
You know, the point is it is something that you're using to achieve an effect. And the effect that we have been saying is that it is to generate chlorine dioxide when, in fact, we are doing it to turn it off.
Well, the other question is, going back to reagent.
Yeah.
Right? Are you sure you're not trying to say reagent?
No,
you're saying reagent.
A reagent. That's chemically what I see that it makes no sense to as anything other than a reagent as opposed to a reagent. It's being used as a reagent makes no sense.
Yeah.
You know, so I could be wrong, but that's I'm.
Then what books do you read, eh?
I've seen the term reagent many places.
Yeah. Are you sure that it's pronounced reagent? Because remember, there's no hyphen.
Okay.
That's my point, eh? So if you're looking at the chem on these secondary reactive acids being used, they just call it a reagent. So if you look at the patent of the stuff that we were just looking at, you know, so when they say that it appears that ascorbic acid is a successful reagent, eh? If it was reagent, it would be RE hyphen agent, eh?
Why?
Reagent.
Here you go. You hear that? I'm just going to a site and I click on it to hear what it says, and here goes.
Reagent.
There it is. Reagent.
So they're saying that that's the proper pronunciation?
That's the proper. In fact, even when they break it out phonetically.
Yep.
They spell it REE-EY, like A,
yeah.
And then dash J-U-H-N-T.
Yeah.
Reagent.
That's it. So it's a okay. Reagent.
So now look at that that chemistry abstract that says reagent.
Reagent.
That's a term that's used in all of these abstracts and all of the papers that I've ever read. Reagent, R-E-A-G-E-N-T. Reagent.
Well, given that there are many other non-chemical uses of the word reagent, that spelling.
So these are actually in the chem papers regarding exactly what we're talking about. So these are the little points. So you can say it however the hell you want to say it. It doesn't really much matter. You know what's going to happen, though? You know, at some point there's going to be some guy like Kalker or one of these guys, and they're going to look at all of the articles, and they're going to pick these apart piece by piece by piece. And they're going to say things like, well, you know, these people don't understand the language. So how can they understand the chemistry? You know, things like that. You know, so when you look at, let's say, the example of sodium chlorite, right, as a compound with citric acid, in other words, the chlorite matrix, you can't write that as ClO2 negative. Because the guy will look at that and he'll start picking you apart right there, right? At some point, it's going to happen. I'm not wrong on this. At some point, some genius is going to go through this shit and draw out one of those 20 little tab things about all of the mistakes.
Well, I'll tell you this. First of all, I acknowledge that. And we have just presumed that that's the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
You know,
but anyway, just like I say, when I get to these parts in these blogs, it actually makes me stop enough to want to phone you. You know, because let's just say I was just Joe Blow, and I get to that, well. And there's another thing here when you're defining this chloride matrix at 28%. The 28% was only valid if you started off with pure sodium chlorate, or chlorite, I mean.
Reagent.
Then you got 28%. But in reality, when you figure out all of the other shit that was added into that actual batch, it might have been 23%.
Yeah, that's actually that is the story about it. MMS is 22.4% effective.
Because it's got sodium chlorate in it and stuff like that.
It's got whatever else it is. It's only 80% sodium chlorite is the bottom line. Like I said, some sources does have chlorate. Some have others, but it's still only 80% sodium chlorite.
Yeah, well, just as long as there's no sodium chlorate, that's a major thing. So now if you wanted to look at the actual chemistry of everything, you would want to look at all of the other atoms or molecules that are involved in, let's say, even the Keevy's Corner stuff, because that's pretty pure.
Yeah.
So, and then find out exactly what is being produced, you know, by the acid reaction, you know, and also by exposure to the things in your body. And how about exposure to sunlight? Exposure to treated water. How about the damn ozone-treated water? If you're looking at all of the things that can possibly be produced, as soon as you go away from clean, pure water and clean, pure product, there's an incredible mess that can be produced. You know, it would be, just to describe the possible end results, you know, in other words, the molecules and the next element and the daughters and all this other kind of stuff, you could be looking at maybe 3,000 words just to describe everything that occurred and the processes involved.
Yeah, sure.
But if you go back to the original pure product, well, then it's very simple. It's going to be, I think it'll be four reasonable paragraphs long. You know, and then there's no chance of any other thing happening, eh?
Well, it is my intention, while you're writing the book, I am going to produce a new documentary that reflects these new understandings, and part of that documentary would include going coming up to Canada. I'd like to track down Cornford, Frost, Herring, and McDowell if they're still with us and where they are. I'd like to visit Dr. Makalakalis at University of Alberta.
Yeah.
Obviously, I'd come see you while I'm there.
Put a tour.
Absolutely. I would also, I'd contact Dr. Brzezinski. I'd like to go see him and meet and talk to him about his product. I think there may be a couple other things that and people that may come to mind from an interview standpoint and from the science standpoint. I might go into an explanation or some form of demonstration of electron or emission spectroscopy that's showing the various emissions themselves and confirming all of that, because that is that's really the key.
No, you're wasting your time doing that. People won't know what that is. If you were to do that, you'd be looking at a 3-hour long program just on that alone. You know, you'd have to start right in the very beginning, you know, of it and explain how it is.
Well, if I'm going to talk to, if I'm able to capture the Cornford at all, and that was the, you know, salient point that they demonstrated, I'm going to have some way of showing what they came up, which confirms and shows why that's that.
Well, instead of that, or you could just reproduce the abstracts that state that it occurs. You can trust the abstract because the science behind it has never been questioned.
I agree.
Like to explain to people exactly what, you know, like let's say electron emission or atomic emission spectroscopy is, forget it.
Well,
but like I said, there's four versions of it, and the basis of it all is the work of Edwin Hubble. You know, with that, you know, red shift, blue shift stuff. Eh?
Sure.
You know, so that's where it goes back to. You know, that was the original idea of a barcode, eh? That's where the barcode idea came from his work, eh?
Well, see, with all this is all relevant, and it's, to me, this is how you do shift people or help people embrace new methods of confirmation.
The thing is, If you involve their minds in that kind of stuff, they can never verify what you're saying anyway. So it's either they can trust the work of the professional people that wrote the abstract, or they can trust your words. But they can't verify it either way. They can't actually, you know, drive up to a lab, find a parking spot, walk in, and have this work explained. You don't actually demonstrate it. Because the demonstration of it is actually, it's a different place. You know, like what you're looking at, it's a different thing. You know, I've never been in a lab seeing that occur, but I've done all of the stuff, you know, the due diligence. You know, I've looked at all of the videos on it and read papers and books, and I have books on a lot of that right here. You know, whether it be laser technology or aquametry, you know, microwave aquametry. And that's basically what we're talking about here now, eh?
I'm not really looking to have them redo or perform the whole thing. I intend to talk about it. I intend to talk about their findings and their work, and I intend to show the results. I think it all supports that this is it supports that this is actually what our objective is, not generating chlorine dioxide, but creating or following a method that actually has been shown.
Yeah.
To detoxify and or eliminate it.
There's another question here that I would offer you.
Mm-hmm.
When the chlorine dioxide actually disappears, right, exactly where does it disappear to? Because, you know, whatever it's generating, the original mole is not increasing. You know, like when they say that the chlorine dioxide is actually regenerated back into sodium chloride. Well, the measurements before and after, the mole isn't changing. So does it revert to its original state? Or does it go somewhere else?
Well...
So then you look at ormes, orbitally rearranged monoatomic elements. Now, is that part of the picture? You see, when you get into the actual chemistry of it, there are actually a lot of different questions are raised.
There.
Now, where does this pervasive, indestructible species of dioxin go? And what causes the bonds to break up? If they do break up, what if they just change their reality?
Well, there are also, I can't think of the term. There is a matrix of pairs, of mineral pairings.
All of them.
Say that again?
All of them.
Yeah, I know there are, but there's states that can go from one state to another, and there's a matrix of relationships of this particular, like chlorine will be something else, or magnesium and calcium, and there is a matrix of them. So
I know what you're trying to say. You're looking at the daughter stuff, eh? And the daughter stuff works both ways. You know, the changing states of the atom because of the transfer of electrons? Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm not talking about that. There's a guy, Kevran's work. Louis Kevran.
Kevran?
Yes.
Dr. Louis Kevran.
That's him. Biological transmutations.
That's old stuff. Did you actually read this stuff?
I've read some of it.
It says here, long before the discovery of cold fusion,
yeah,
by Pons and Fleischmann, other scientists had variously found phenomenal evidence of non-radioactive low-energy transmutation of light elements in plant, animal, and minerals. So, yeah, that's another thing. So if you're looking back at the old stuff, how can that be? Because you know that Max Planck is right. You know, when he defines, you know, the quantum of the so-called particles of light, in other words, the photon.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the photon is real.
I know that.
They changed the value ever so slightly. You know, the actual mathematical value?
Yeah.
They changed the value ever so slightly downward, but the photon is genuine. So if we're talking about the actual transmutation of light or light energy, how can that occur? You have to find superluminals. That's the only way. Now, is it possible that superluminals are actually being produced in plants or animals or minerals? So that is the question. For this biological transmutation thing, you know, with this plant, to be real, how are you going to actually change the state of light? And what do we know about actually changing that state of light? You know, like looking at lasers and stuff like that, eh?
Well, I would imagine superluminals are involved in all change.
Yeah. Well, the decay can lead to that, yes, because you have the solid state, the liquid state, the gas state.
And we have other states that we are not generally aware of.
That's true. But a prime example of this is iridium decaying to its gas state, radon. And the radon is definitely a superluminal.
Okay.
But does this process actually take place in a human cell? Remember I was telling you about the star in a jar stuff? You know, the fuser?
Yeah.
Okay, now I wrote a thing about that on the internet, one of these blogs, and one of those guys wrote back to me and said, hey, this is all new shit. Why don't you publish this and blah, blah, blah? So they can see the truth of it, eh?
Yeah.
So if there is a fourth part to the Krebs cycle, okay, like when you look at cell respiration, it's divided into three parts. Now, if there is a fourth part to cell respiration, it is going to be in this fuser energy technology.
Uh-huh.
Because all of the parts exist. Acetone, deuterium, energy, vibration, sound. All of these things actually exist to produce star in a jar energy. So if you're talking about the transmutation or whatever of light, that is the only way. Light elements.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So there's definitely something to that. But I don't think that's going to, you know, have a bearing on the development of a free radical. Because there's no part of this that affects a free radical. It affects what a free radical can become, but it can't affect the production of a free radical. Because, you know, remember the light reactive elements or molecules?
Yeah.
This is the gamma isomer stuff, eh? But this is not the kind of light that's in your body. This is the kind of light that's from the sun. It gets damn complex, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
But you see any truth in what I just said? If there's something about it that bothers you, just say it.
Well, I think that there are, you know, I believe everything affects everything. You know, when you say that it can't affect what a free radical does, I think it can. I think everything can be affected by everything else and is affected by everything else. And I think there is an extra component. Just like you said, that component could very well be, and on some level, that is not physical. It is superluminal, if you will. But
that's faster than light.
I know that. You know, thought's faster than light. You know, so consciousness is, in my opinion, at least it is light. It's a form of light, but you can't see it.
Yeah.
Intention is. So there are connections, and we are part of, you know, we look at everything that we can measure as being real, but reality isn't limited by what we can measure.
Well, through the emission spectroscopy, we can definitely produce fact, which states that chlorine dioxide exists.
Yes, I agree.
Okay. We also know that it's a free radical, and its state, when you look at the actual molecule, there's something really different about it. But now, looking at that free radical itself, just in the case of chlorine dioxide of either species, is it produced in nature? Okay, that's a good question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it produced in nature? Well, that answer is no. It's not produced in nature. And why is that? Well, because the parts that produce the chlorine dioxide are not present in nature. It's very rare that you're going to find, well, let's say, the potential of interaction in between, let's say, sodium chlorate or sodium chlorite with a mild acid, you know, like in nature. Because remember, everything is in nature is inanimate. You know, it just sits there. The only thing that actually moves are, you know, the atmosphere, a certain amount of water in the atmosphere, and the rivers. Whatever gravity can affect, you know, in nature, it's pretty much stationary.
Well, they appear,
that's alive moves,
they appear to be. The atoms are moving all the time. There's space between each one of those electrons, so it just appears to be. It has a field, and the field.
So let's just take that a step farther. Mm-hmm. Let's just say that you find a relatively significant amount of, let's say, sodium chlorate. Where did it come from, and how did it get there? Okay, so then you backtrack it, because wherever there's sodium chlorite, there's going to be sodium chlorate. So how did that get there? Where did it come from? And then you go back to sodium chloride. Where is the sodium chloride? Well, sodium chloride in that pure state is in seawater. You know, pure sodium chloride, it doesn't exist on land, eh?
Uh-huh.
It's a product of seawater, eh? So when you're looking at that, okay, now how do you move forward to find, let's say, the potential of citric acid or ascorbic acid or any of these mild acids existing in seawater? Well, in very rare cases they do, eh? You know, the actual production of mild acids from plankton and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know that all of the tests that are done on seawater, you know, and what's venting off of it, no one ever mentions chlorine dioxide. Now, that's interesting, eh?
So therefore, as a natural process,
it's very rare.
It's fair to say that it doesn't happen.
Well, it does happen, but it's very rare.
Yeah, okay.
A particular set of conditions would have to be met. You know, the right places with the right temperatures to produce the right algae that could possibly produce the right mild acids in the presence of seawater, and how much of that seawater actually has chlorine, because that's where you have to go back to, right? You have to go back to sodium chloride. So, what is sodium chloride? Then how you need chlorine? How much of the sea is chlorine? Well, about 2.1%. And 25% of that is the 37 ion. The 35 is predominant, eh?
Uh-huh.
So when you take it forward through all the possibilities, I mean, it is kind of slim that you could possibly produce the free radical chlorine dioxide in either species.
And yet every cell must have a chloride atom within it, at least if it's got a chance to be healthy.
Well, yeah, because that's part of the pump, eh?
Yeah, so that's 100% of a chloride, even though only maybe 2% or some small percent of a chlorine and any of these other things that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I think some people go the total binary where they're either all on or all off, so that anything that has something to do with chlorine is wrong or somehow dangerous, when in fact, I mean, that's a very one-dimensional view of life, when in fact these components, in the particular chloride, is important for everything.
Well, you know, when you look at the sodium-potassium pump, it's an absolute guarantee that there's going to be a specific amount of pure elemental chlorine that is left behind in the cell, and also in your body. There's just no way out of it. Now, the stuff that's actually in the cell deals with it, though, just like it deals with potassium 40, as an example, eh?
Right.
The cell deals with it, it accelerates its half-life, and the body sheds it, you know, through the various ways that you shed poisons out of your body. So the body has got, you know, it's got that stuff figured out. But to go back to the original point, though, biological transmutation, when you actually look at how this could possibly be, well, all real, eh? You're only going to get to the nanotubes. You know, when I talk about the voltage-gated ion channels?
Yeah.
Well, the stuff that we're talking about here, you know, if we're looking at the star in a jar, you know, the fuser stuff? Well, that has everything to do with the nanotubes. So those are voltage-gated nanotubes. And they're carbon. They're carbon tubes.
Okay.
So if the change of light energy is actually occurring in the cell, the parts are truly there. Like I could write this out and actually support it. I've never, ever done it. You know, I didn't figure this out until about a year ago, 9 months maybe.
Uh-huh.
You know, how the human body's temperature stays constant and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, the shiver response, all that other kind of stuff.
Sure.
You know, the vibration of the star in a jar idea produces even more greater energy, eh?
Hmm.
So the shiver response, that increases the vibration in your complete cell structure, therefore producing more star in a jar effect, the fuser effect.
Okay.
So therefore, when you look at how we regulate our body temperature and everything, well, that truly does make sense. The thing that actually backs this up is the fact that there is phosphorescence in these nanotubes. And also, your cell continually produces gamma. It's actually produced by yourself.
Yeah, it's a little sun.
Well, the gamma itself is a byproduct of a specific decay. So you look at what produces gamma. You know, like, let's say you crack your Chemdex, you look at what produces gamma and in what percentages. So, now the presence of gamma is actually what made me write about the decay of chlorine-37 becoming chlorine-38. Because all that has to happen is there has to be not even an impact, just the presence of a free neutron. And you're going to get chlorine-38. And inside of the cell, the chlorine-38 would last for a microsecond. You know, if you use the scale of the potassium-40?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If the potassium-40 lasts, instead of a billion-plus years, it lasts 31 days, I think it was. You know, like in the cell, the half-life drops to 31 days.
Uh-huh.
So if you use that scale, right... Let's just do a little bit of quick algebra, and you could actually figure it out into microseconds. How long the chlorine-38 would last in the cell before it becomes, remember what it becomes? That's a good assignment for you.
Chlorine-38 becomes?
Yeah, chlorine-38, so just look at chlorine-38 daughter. Just type that in. Chlorine-38 daughter.
All right.
So actually, the way to write it is 17 Cl-38 daughter.
Oh, here's a chart. 17 Cl stable. What's the daughter? Daughter. Here we go. Let's see here. It says stable.
Yeah, the 38 chlorine becomes a stable isotope.
Yeah, that's what it... Oh.
But which one is it?
I would assume it's a chloride.
No, it changes its element name. It doesn't change its electron count, but it changes its designation, eh? The element itself changes.
Argon?
There you go. So now you would write that out as, you look at your chart of elements, and which element number is argon? So if the chlorine is 17, where's the argon? So you look at a chart of elements, your 17th element is chlorine. Okay? So what number is the argon? Is it up or is it down? Just punch up a chart of elements. Want you to actually do this, eh?
That's what I'm doing now.
Yeah, okay, so now look at where the chlorine is. That's 17, right? The 17th element is chlorine.
Yeah, there it is.
Okay, so where's argon?
Argon's right next to it.
But which side?
It's to the right. It's 18.
Okay, so it's higher. So now when you write that out, you have to write down 18 argon, and then what would be the number? The electron count would be 38, eh?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so that's how that goes.
Alrighty.
So that's how you're, when you're looking at, when I write about looking at possible elements produced, you know, molecules produced, and which daughters and whether they're stable or not, that's what I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
Are they stable or aren't they? Because if they're not stable, well, then that's really bad. You know, that's like ionizing radiation. Yeah. So if they're stable, that's good. If they're not stable, it's bad. So the chlorine 38 can be a bad thing, but for a microsecond, and then it becomes the next element up. But it does it in a different way. It doesn't change its electron count, so what does change? So there's only the three particles, right?
Right. Well, its weight, its molecular weight changes.
Yeah, that because it becomes the next element.
Right.
It becomes a heavier element. But what is changing? Is it an electron, or is it a proton, or is it a neutron? So those are the things you want to look at.
Okay.
But decay production, usually one particular element, or should say particle, is shed. Usually, it's going to be a neutron. But not all the time. That's why when I talk about things such as the heavy water or the tritium, you know, you go from ordinary H2O, you go to deuterium, and then you go to tritium. So what's changing? You know, the nucleus is becoming heavier, right?
I see.
Yeah. So that's why they call it heavy water. The nucleus is becoming heavier. It's still classified as water, but it's with a heavy nucleus. And then a heavier nucleus, which actually changes into a gas state, which is really odd, because tritium is all gas, eh? So, like, you ever seen an accurate photograph or a video of the inside of a reactor, and you got that blue haze in there?
Yeah.
Well, that's tritium, the development of tritium gas, eh?
All right.
Cool, though. The thing about it is, if you want to write all this shit out like that, well, don't overreach, eh? You know, be sure. Be sure, because it's an open attack, eh?
I'm going to be as sure as I can be.
Well, remember what those assholes did to me in them blogs, eh?
Well, guess what? They did it to me in my blog as well, and I'm still here. So I have, with your help, my view, I've changed my view, I am acknowledging it, and I'm going to put it down as best I can now. You know, they're going to do what they're going to do regardless.
Well, it's not because of what I'm doing. You actually see the truth of this, so you're going to reproduce the truth. It wouldn't matter if it came from me or from somewhere else.
My point basically is that people who, and the truth is, some of the critics, I actually see what they're talking about. You know, so the point is that so be it. You know, I'm going to put it out as best I know. And as things change, or if things change, I'll modify that.
I wondered if you were going to ever say that, you know, about the critics.
Yeah.
Because whatever they're saying is incomplete also.
I know. I agree that. I see that too.
Yeah.
You know?
But the data crunching actually pulls it all together. That's how this can be described. The simple idea of data crunching, researching all of the papers and finding out what reactions are, what is produced, what isn't produced, all this other kind of stuff, the state of change of molecules, yeah, well, this actually tells you right away. And if it wasn't for me finding that NIOSH article on the automate the water stuff, eh? I would have never realized that there could be two, in other words, a safe version of chlorine dioxide.
Right.
Because the only safe version is the one that isn't there. How do you get rid of a chlorine dioxide molecule that's pervasive and lives, lasts in that state for 300,000 plus years? You know, and that's what the word is when you're reading about the chemical difficulties, you know, in actually dealing with chlorine dioxide, eh?
Uh-huh.
It's the fact that it lasts 300,000 years is above all. And now, chlorine dioxide is measurable in every water supply in North America. You know, in the riverbeds and, you know, the sandy loam around the rivers and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Chlorine dioxide as a molecule, the bad molecule, is in every watershed. Every watershed, even where there was never industry involving it. So that's why when I said in that answer to that, whoever the hell that guy was, in that one blog that you had posted, when I talked about, you know, my goal, or my original goal was to find a way to actually eliminate chlorine dioxide. You know, a secondary process of eliminating it, eh?
Yeah.
And that's what took me into this all of this research. So I recognized the danger of it, eh?
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, anything that's put together unnaturally, because it's not natural, it can be taken apart.
Good.
Yeah.
And see, just as a non sequitur, I'll say, and that includes genetic engineering.
Yes, the genetic engineering, which involves the lateral gene transfer and monoatomic gold, that can be taken apart too.
Yeah. I mean, most people right now, we're attempting one just to get things labeled.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, labeling isn't enough. It's learning how to turn it off.
Yeah. In other words, you eat whatever the hell that you have to, and then just go home and take a pill and you're fine.
Yeah, there you go. You know, so that's it.
So that would be DMSO that is very likely programmable.
In a positive way. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing that we can talk about sometime. You know, like an on-air thing. When we do talk about DMSO, I am going to have all of the information sitting right in front of me, talking points in an order, and I'll email them to you. And we'll go through DMSO, how it is used and how it can be used at home. I don't know if you really want to do that, but...
No, I do, because I do apply it to myself here. And I sometimes get, for a while, somewhat of a burning feeling. And, of course, I believe that's the action that's happening as things are being inactivated. I think those HeLa cells are going down. But, yeah, it passes. It's not a big deal, even a bad deal, but I notice it.
Well, if I was you, though, I'd be standing in that shower for a while using no soap at all.
Mm-hmm.
And clean your body off with a towel the best you can before you put it on.
Okay.
And, you know, if you're using the pure stuff, and if you want to program it with the MMS, use a very small amount.
Mm-hmm.
To activate the MMS, give it all the time in the damn world, whatever, you know, like give it minutes instead of just the 3 minutes. Give it longer. Give it 6 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Just to make sure that it's stable, and then just take, let's say, a dropper and put a single drop in, let's say, a quarter of a cup of DMSO.
Uh-huh.
And then use that. You know, I mean, I don't know how much you want to put on. Let's say you just want to rub your foot or your arm or something like that. It's not going to take very much.
Yeah, I don't make that much. I don't know if I make a half, maybe an ounce or so. I use these shot glasses, and I put a small amount in the bottom of two shot glasses to equal amounts of distilled water and the DMSO.
Yep.
Then I mix them, and, of course, they heat up. Then I just apply it topically.
Well, you know that you got to let that react until it stops.
Yeah. Yeah, but you feel, you know, you're aware of the that it's happening, and you feel the warmth of it as it does.
Are you pouring the right one into the other one? There's one that has to be poured into the other, eh?
I pour the water into the DMSO.
Well, is that what the chemistry sheet says?
I haven't seen a sheet anywhere, so what do I know?
There is one. Look it up.
Yeah. All right. I'll check.
The pharmaceutical DMSO mixing, etc.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to get off the phone here.
All right then, man.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Okay, see you now. Bye-bye.